And welcome to Last Man Standing here with me, Paul Stevenson, on this Sunday, the 18th of August, 2024. With you here on Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. So do go to the homepage and support us to keep us on the air. Because in light of what's happening in the UK, and we'll get to that later today, it's even more important to keep free speech alive. So do support us. With all that said, very happy to be joined with Dr. Patrick Slattery. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
You're very welcome, as ever. And like I alluded to, the UK under the Prime Ministership and government, Labour government, have gone full-on, crazy, authoritarian-styly when it comes to free speech and imprisoning as many whiteys as they possibly can. This has obviously reached in the international community as well. You had Elon Musk, comment on it negatively, and there's been some tension with him. And even Ted Cruz referred to as the Magna Carta being up in flames. So the world has been looking on. I doubt whether that's going to make any difference, but presumably you've been following this stuff, Patrick, somewhat.
I have been following it, and you have, I guess, would she be the home minister, the person who is the point man or point woman on this charge against the civil liberties of people, especially white people? What? Who am I speaking about? She's got kind of short hair. She looks kind of like if you took Liz Truss and then. Yeah, she looks like a lesbian. If you took Liz Truss and put her into a blender or stuck her head in a blender, or maybe stuck her head in a toilet and flushed it, that's what she'd look like. Who am I talking about?
You're talking about the complete tyrant known as Yvette Cooper.
Yvette Cooper, yeah.
And this woman, when I knew there was going to be a Labour government, it was this woman that I dreaded more than anything. Because she has always been at the forefront of, clamping down and zero tolerance on anything that's, far right or racist or anything. And true to form, she has been participating in this clampdown. In fact, I just saw a story today that more aggressive rhetoric, that they're going to increase their efforts to crush, how was it described, hurtful and hateful ideologies. As usual, of course, the problem is these people get to decide what's hateful and what's acceptable and what's criminal. Yvette Cooper. The Home Secretary today has announced, I'm seeing this in Sky News, a crackdown on people, quote, pushing hateful beliefs.
Righto. And those beliefs are it's not a problem. She's not trying to crack down on actual crime, right? Is she saying that grooming has gotten out of hand, stabbing's gotten out of hand? Is there any of that? Or is it simply
no.
Hurting people's imagine? I mean, and here's the thing. To what extent are people's feelings really hurt? Like the black and brown people, your Muslims, your immigrants, your various minorities. If somebody, let's just say, makes a sticker that says White Lives Matter, how much does that really hurt anybody's feelings in the first place?
Well, exactly. You're talking about, of course, Sam Melia. Kudos to Mark Collett and some of the patriotic alternative community. They went up there outside, they gave a speech outside the prison in Hull last week, where he's unjustly, of course, imprisoned for producing bumper stickers which basically said White Lives Matter. And you're right, one of the great outrages over here and causes of detention is this two-tier policing and two-tier justice, because, you know, at breakneck speed, we've had over 1,000 people now, you know, who have been arrested, many of them charged, many of them for rather innocuous kind of tweets. There's been a couple that are genuinely inciting, you know, violence, and people who've got obviously carried away with the emotions, etc. And, you know, but one guy, after pleading guilty, I nearly, you know, fell off my chair. After pleading guilty, he got 20 months, and that's with a reduction of a third. So if he had have pleaded not guilty and then was found guilty, he would have been to prison for 60 months, 5 years. As it is, he got 20 months for a tweet. You know, albeit this particular tweet was inciting violence towards one of the asylum seekers' hotels, I believe. But there was other tweets way more innocuous than that, and Facebook posts where people were obviously panicked and intimidated into pleading not guilty as well, because I think some of them, pleading guilty, so they get a reduced sentence. But that's all part of the intimidation, I think. It was to say, is they all rushed it through. Let's get as many whiteys in prison for, you know, as possible, for as long as possible. Meanwhile, the country and the Labour government are known to be soft on crime. They are known to, you know, have resided over, like, you know, and supported policies which are very soft on crime. I mean, and there is
well,
a real.
And they're letting, aren't they letting violent criminals out of prison early in order to free up space?
Well, one of the first things, and I mentioned this to you at the time before the riots brought out, when the Labour government came in, one of the first things they announced, which raised my eyebrows and other eyebrows, was that they were going to be releasing people from prison because the prisons were too full. All of a sudden, this was a great priority of the Labour government. So among those, you're going to be talking about people who are ostensibly a danger to society. And I remember thinking at the time, what's the big, what's so important about freeing up prison places? I remember thinking maybe they want to free up more places for more people like Sam Melia and me and you, Patrick, you know. And by the way, I say you because you're not a UK citizen, but the British government has been throwing its weight around threatening all sorts of people. You know, we will come after you even if you're overseas. So, I mean,
threatening even Elon Musk. Where does Elon Musk live? Does he live in California or Texas? But they're
California.
They're like hinting that they would try to get him extradited.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they're not doing themselves any favors in terms of support on the international scene. You even had Ted Cruz, like I said, condemned the Labour government and others. There's a politician in Germany condemned Starmer and Yvette Cooper for the way they're handling things. But I mean, suddenly, very suddenly, they are, you know, constantly talking about law and order, and you're going to feel the full force of the law, and we need a crackdown on hateful ideologies or whatever it was I described them. So you know, you have this obvious double standard, and when it comes to crime, when it comes to who is being on the receiving end of this tough new Labour stance on law and order, you know. So I've lost count of it now, but there's been over 1,000 people been arrested, and there's been over 150 people have been prosecuted with pretty, you know, reasonable sentences, in some cases outrageous sentences. And to say, I think part of the intimidation is to get people to immediately plead guilty, probably by, you know, advised by some duty solicitor who are notoriously, will notoriously advise people to plead guilty to avoid harsher sentences. When I think in some cases that even people have been imprisoned for things which may not even be against the law. But if you're intimidated enough and, you know, you can plead guilty, then, you know, you're going to get a lesser sentence, but a stiff sentence, you know, all the same, you know. So, I mean, it's getting very claustrophobic. And when you get down to the minutiae of it, when you look at the type of things people are being prosecuted for, you know, you're looking at, you know, there's some serious semantics gymnastics going on and some serious linguistic leisure domain being employed, because it's all very nebulous and it's all very ambiguous. And of course, I believe that's deliberately so, so that they can prosecute with expediency, you know, because people's heads are spinning, not really knowing where they are with the law on this. And judges are standing up there basically saying, well, this could have been interpreted and this might have been interpreted this way. It's getting to the point when you look at some of the tweets, it's like, okay, well, it'd be easier if you could tell us what's not criminal than what is criminal at this point, you know?
Right. So, and earlier I mentioned, or I asked whether these black and brown and various minority people are like, even if their feelings are being hurt. But of course, you know, I'm asking that not rhetorically. I'm just asking that because I wonder. But at the same time, it doesn't matter whether people's feelings are being hurt. If you are going to have a democracy or any other kind of mass participation political system, people have to be able to take opposing points of view. People have to be able to say things that are going to upset those who disagree with them. People have to be able to disagree. And not just on a small subset of issues that the ruling elite says is okay. It should be on anything.
Just you were saying, I mean, that is almost literally where we're going, because there was one, I forget, and I think the guy has been sent to prison, but on one of the tweets, it was included in his indictment was the term he used in his tweets, anti-establishment rhetoric. I kid you not, that was part of the indictment against him. He used anti-establishment rhetoric.
Well, okay. So if you can't criticize the establishment, then how can you define the system as anything other than dictatorship? If you're not even allowed to, yeah. So right now they're able to get away with a lot of this stuff. What I wonder. Because right now, as many problems as there are, the system is still functioning. People are still going to the supermarket and they find food on the groceries, or the grocery on the shelves. They find they've got their places to live. Their society is still kind of functioning, and I'm not saying that there's going to be a total collapse, but we do seem to be headed to some sort of maybe a kind of a partial collapse, where as a result of the realignment of the international system around Russia and China, and I don't see any way to put off or at least to prevent a collapse of Ukraine. What's going on in the Middle East, there's not really any good outcome for it. If Israel gets their way, then we have World War III. If they don't get their way, then there's a collapse of the state of Israel. So I'm wondering how much of this type of draconian crackdown on domestic dissent, well, how is that going to play out in a situation where there's kind of a collapse?
I lost you there for about 20 seconds. I heard you saying, you know, if Israel, you know, if they lose, then there'll be the collapse of the state of Israel, which would probably lead to a nuclear attack by Israel.
So there's all this upheaval in the international system that is just over the horizon. So the basic question is, they're getting away with a lot of this internal crackdown now. What's it going to be like when the situation for Britain, situation for the United States, situation for France is collapsing on the international system? They lose a lot of the power resources that they have, and it's helped them keep the market shelves full and things like that. What do you think? Do you think there's any a possibility that there's going to be a lot of people sparked by the events overseas?
Well, there certainly will be. I think it's going to be a lot of upheaval if this war in the Middle East kicks off. I mean, everyone's been anticipating this retaliatory response from Iran, which hasn't occurred yet. But we know that, you know, Netanyahu and others who are, you know, the Ben Gavirs of this world and Smotrich and people like that are hell-bent on complete hegemony for that in that region, and they want their war. I mean, that's going to be a disaster one way or another economically. It's going to be ripple effects of that will be felt all over the world, I think, including the West. What you're suggesting is a more kind of widespread collapse of society type situation?
Not quite collapse of society, but and maybe when my connection was poor, I was using the term like kind of partial collapse. I don't really expect the type of thing that people on alternative radio have been speculating about for decades. You know, a complete collapse. But so for instance, when things fell apart in the Soviet Union, you had a period of time where store shelves were pretty much empty, where people were literally freezing to death. They have a much colder climate, but you know, things had gotten really, really bad. But even if it doesn't get to that point, if you have a great upheaval in the international system, well, there's a lot of things that could happen to trigger high inflation. I'm not talking about necessarily Weimar Republic style hyperinflation, but high inflation. The international markets, you could have a considerable weakening of the dollar and the pound and the euro. They could weaken considerably, and these countries are so reliant on imported goods, and then all of a sudden, what happens if you're getting 20% inflation? You know, forget runaway hyperinflation, but double dip 10%, 20%, 15% inflation.
I think we already have that, but they're just lying about it. I mean, I heard a statistic the other day saying the British government was saying that inflation is down to 2%. That's completely absurd. I don't even think, like in America, they don't even, and when they do the consumer pricing, the CPI index, they don't even think they include rent in that. And I don't think the British government do either. I mean, rents are going crazy. That's another reason why people are against mass immigration, because it creates so much demand and it sends rents through the roof, which are already massively high. Most of the inflation in the UK is in the housing market. You know, the housing market is basically what props up the British economy.
Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so, and you mentioned the mass immigration. And if we do have the chaos in the international system, if you get Israel gets its way and initiates at least a broad regional war in the Middle East, if not real war, World War III, well, even just the relatively small Syrian civil war was used as a pretext for people from everywhere from Nigeria to Bangladesh to tromp all across Europe and into the UK. It was, oh, they're fleeing the brutal Syrian civil war. If you have a much larger scale war,
of course, as usual,
who are the bad guys? Who are the bad guys? The people who are swamping into the country, or the people who are complaining about it?
Well, this is where you're at now. You see, in terms of if you dare actually just shine a light on mass immigration as even a contributing cause to, for example, to the riots over here recently, and then you're vilified and criminalized. Not, you know, there's not a discussion to be had. Just the mere fact that people are fed up to the back teeth of mass immigration is enough to, you know, have you feel the full force of the law. I mean, these types of terms are constantly being thrown around. I mean, it's so aggressive. And in the Middle East, of course, a lot of the, you know, Tommy Robinson, working class Brits sort of people, they never, you know, look at Israel and say, okay, every time there seems to be a war in the Middle East, we get flooded with even more immigrants, because it's the latest excuse, not that they need one, for, you know, millions more to come. And that's what will happen again, I'm sure, if that war gets out of control. But no one ever points a finger at Israel, because people in the West are so brainwashed that there would be complete peace in the Middle East if it wasn't for those horrible Iranians who are constantly aggressive. I really sort of, I almost give up when I hear people like Douglas Murray and these people defending Israel constantly. I mean, it doesn't matter what Israel does, they're always a victim to a certain audience in the UK, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so there, I guess there's still a very, very outside chance that that something could happen in Israel where you get the current government collapse, a new government come in without Ben-Gvir, without Smoltrich. I suppose there's a at least some sort of minimal chance of that, but it doesn't seem very likely. It seems like kind of the least likely scenario. And the two likely scenarios being in starting a war in the Middle East that's going to be very long and protracted, and one where the it's not long and protracted, and Israel winds up getting spanked. It's not able to get the giant conflagration involving the United States. And by the way, did you see your big black foreign minister and France's little gay foreign minister were in Israel meeting with the Israeli foreign minister, who, his name is Israel. What's his name? Israel Katz. The three of them took a picture together, and I sent it to Mark Dankoff, and I said, you know, one's black, one's gay, one's a Jew. Can you identify who's who? But but yeah. The thing is, if it doesn't go well, then you've got, I mean, Israel's playing kind of a double or nothing game, and it's very possible that Hezbollah and Iran, that they are going to be able to hit Israeli targets everywhere in Israel. And then what happens? Then, I mean, you could have a mass exodus of Jews from Israel, not necessarily because it's being pushed into the sea, but the Jews in Israel have not, they've never had to live like their Arab neighbors, who just have to accept that a bomb can come down in their neighborhood and kill people they know, including themselves. They've had massive security. And so what's going to happen? And so many of these do have foreign passports. What would, I don't know if
they'll all end up in Europe.
What if a bunch of Israeli Jews showed up in Britain?
Well, that's probably what would happen. If a full scale war broke out, and if Israel actually experienced anything akin to what it's presented as, because, like I said, the Zionist supporters are in the UK and around the world, they're constantly fed this narrative that Israel's just like, it's just constantly defending itself, and that everything it does, it's always in self-defense. So it's like, you look at what happens in Gaza, it's just basically filtered through people's idea that Israel's always in the defensive. And like you said, they live in tremendous security in comparison to the Palestinians, for example. And, I think they won't have the stomach for it if they're actually affected by a real war, if the bombs start dropping on Tel Aviv and places like that properly, not silly little rockets that the Iron Dome takes out and then they make a big deal of it. And so we'll see. But, I mean, if Iran are going to you know, retaliate, they're certainly taking their time.
And so, you know, I'm not an expert in Iranian foreign and military policy. The what Alexander Mercuris is and his gang and Judge Andy Napolitano and his gang, what seems to be the consensus emerging from their guest list is that that Iran is preparing something that can't be rushed. They're preparing something that would be serious and requires diplomacy with Russia and China and military preparations. It requires getting missile defense systems from Russia up and running. And so don't interpret the their taking their time as an indication that they're chickening out. That's what I hear.
Well, like you said, they know what who and what they're dealing with, and you know any attack and any strike on Israel will be inevitably met with the usual disproportionate, over the top response from Israel. So they will be preparing for that. So it'll also depend on how effective the any initial strike is as to how Israel can respond. And then you mentioned, you know, Russia and China, but I mean, we haven't even discussed what's been happening in Russia, on Russian territory, this incursion. Wasn't this a red line for Putin? I mean, we heard the, authorization of long-range weapons. We discussed all that. Of course, the West has, in many cases, set its own red lines and imposed them on Russia rather than red lines that Putin has outlined. But I think that what happened there with the Ukrainian incursion into Russia, that would, qualify as a red line, no, for Putin. But so, well, I mean, yeah, that's it.
I think it is a red line. And
so what's he gonna do?
Well, okay, I'll tell you what I think. First, I just want to say it's certainly an embarrassment for Russia. Similar to what happened a year or so ago with Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner group, doing an attempt at bullying Putin, maybe even a coup d'etat, but it wasn't presented as a coup d'etat. That was an embarrassment. It was taken care of very, very promptly, and in the end, it had the positive results of bringing this large mercenary army under the control of the Russian Ministry of Defense. And then 2 years ago, you had the Russian strategic withdrawal from Kharkov and from Kherson, and that involved some blundering, in not in so much military, but political blundering, because
you are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Did you know the IRS publicly admits that income tax is collected by voluntary compliance? Get the information you need to help you avoid income tax with these 5 easy steps. All you have to do is go to avoidincometax.com to get your 5 easy steps on how to avoid the IRS income tax. Escape the IRS. Let avoidincometax.com help you. We guarantee our 5 easy steps or your money back. Go to avoidincometax.com.
Hey, do you have a house or office with a musty smell or mold? Studies have shown that essential oils like the ones in our Thief and Robbers blend will kill or inhibit mold, viruses, bacteria, or fungus. Just diffuse with it, and you'll see the long-lasting effects that even synthetic chemicals don't achieve. Check us out at SusannahSecret.com. That's SusannahSecret.com. secret.com. That's S-U-S-A-N-A-S, secret.com.
People often write to tell us what has happened for them since starting Extendivite. Allow me to read a few. In 1 month, my blood pressure dropped significantly. I no longer get chest pain after exercise. It's amazing, and I ordered my second bottle. The reviews are spot on. My target is to get off BP meds, and if it keeps going like this, I see a light at the end of the tunnel. So far, a great product is what it claims to be. Great product. A few days in, and I could feel a difference for certain. Not checking medical stats yet. I know this is really working by how I feel. We'll continue to take this product. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email ProudSouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
I'm so excited to have you as part of the Wild Pastures family, and we look forward to bringing you the pasture-raised meats that you and your family will love. Now, we started Wild Pastures because so many of my clients would tell me they just couldn't find high-quality pasture-raised meats, and even when they did, it was so expensive that they couldn't afford to eat it regularly. Now, I'm not talking about the bottom-of-the-barrel healthy meats that have claims like natural or free-range or even cage-free, terms that were actually created by the industrial food industry to make us feel all warm and fuzzy about buying their low-quality products. I'm talking about truly nourishing pasture-raised meats, the kind that you'll never really find in a grocery store. Our farmers are doing things beyond organic. Our beef is 100% grass-fed and grass-finished and raised on pastures free from chemicals and other pesticides. Our chickens are 100% pasture-raised, where they get their natural diet of grass and forage and insects. We will never settle for free range, which is actually one of the most deceptive terms in the chicken industry. In fact, less than 0.1% of the chicken consumed in the United States is truly pasture-raised in the way that ours is. And our pork is 100% pasture-raised as well. So if you care about where your food comes from, then you have definitely made it to the right place. As a Wild Pastures member, you'll be supporting the most highly principled farmers in America and getting the most nutrient-dense, nourishing, and sustainable meats in the world. I'm confident you'll love being part of our mission at Wild Pastures, and you will really love the delicious, nourishing meats that we're going to deliver straight to your door.
Visit republicbroadcasting.org and click the Wild Pastures banner ad. Secure a shipment today. Beef, poultry, and pork. Raised the way nature intended.
Health Simple with Colorado Shielji. Fact bit number one. What goes in must come out. Whatever we ingest, breathe in, or transfer by contact must be expelled. Expelled directly as burned calories, through perspiration, respiration, or expelled via urinary and gastric channels. Every element that is not properly used or removed by our bodies become toxins. And toxins, as we know, are causal to every disease and ailment. Toxins are what makes us subpar, unable to be at our best. Be your healthy best by cleansing your body of daily and deeply embedded toxins. Live stronger, and we hope live longer. Shilajit, legit Shilajit, that is, like Colorado Shilajit, is perhaps the greatest homeopathic whole body remover of toxins made by Mother Earth.
Look for the gold mountain and medical symbol logo in banners on republicbroadcasting.org to watch the full video and see more information. Use code GORBN when ordering. That's G-O-R-B-N.
You know, that involved some blundering, not in so much military, but political blundering. Because while the Russian military was able to withdraw successfully from areas that it wasn't in a position to defend, and kill an awful lot of Ukrainians in the process, because they moved into, again, the positions that cannot be defended, and now then they were in the crosshairs. Politically, it was very bad, because the people who had cooperated or welcomed the Russians in those two cities then became at the mercy of the Ukrainians who came in. So I think this is on the one hand, you know, it is an embarrassment, and it's going to bring some criticism at Putin and his team. On the other hand, these people who the Ukrainians who have invaded, they're not going to be able to establish any kind of control over this area. I guess the idea had been to try to capture the Kursk nuclear power plant and then maybe try to trade it for the Zaporizhia power plant, but that's failed. And so So the troops who are in Russia now are probably never ever leaving. They're probably going to be either captured or eliminated. And so, in terms of being a military plus or minus, it's, for Ukraine, is a massive minus. There's just not only losing more troops, which they do every day, but losing some of their best troops. So I think it was a blunder for Ukraine, but for Russia, it's an embarrassment, but it still might. But okay, so crossing the red line, what is the consequence of crossing the red line? Well, the consequence of crossing the red line is Putin has just shut the door on negotiations at this point. That there's nobody to negotiate with. So at least symbolically, the door had been open to negotiations until this time, and now it's just been slammed shut. And with no negotiations, what does that mean? Well, that means that this is just going to be, as far as the Russians intend, it's going to be settled on Russian dictate, not on negotiations, but Russian dictate. And so what's that going to mean? Is that going to mean taking Odessa and Nikolaev and whatever they want? That seems to me what it's going to lead to.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, even Western commentators, once the first couple of days had been over, were asking what is exactly the strategy here from Ukraine, because they recognize, what do they think they're going to do? Take over Russia? Well, I don't know how many men there was. I think it's like maybe only 2,000 or 3,000 Ukrainians. It was well organized, but it is, for them to even have a chance of, maintaining their presence there, it's probably zero, really. Russia has evacuated a lot of the civilians out of that area, and they've already started eliminating massive amounts of Ukrainian military gear and hardware and armored vehicles, and huge losses on the Ukrainian side, and they're using those fab bombs. I don't know what it was. Like you said, it was this idea that they were going to maybe take that Kursk power plant.
But also, I think it's worth remembering that they're always trying to escalate. And, you know, to if Zelensky has his way, he'll do everything and anything to, you know, escalate, to try and create a, you know, some sort of reason to bring in NATO troops or whatever. But it's always primarily been, you know, a media, PR and propaganda campaign, you know, above a military campaign, you know? So it's just in the run-up to election, I guess, it gives the media something to get excited about, where they can say, oh, look, and they've been drooling all over it. A master stroke and a feat of magic, I heard, have been described as by one of our so-called experts in Sky News. He's just a complete moron. He knows nothing and just, you know, pumps out constant propaganda. So I think it's just something where, you know, the Biden administration can say they've had some sort of success. And then, of course, from Putin's point of view, he's probably hoping that, you know, that by the time the election comes around, that maybe someone will come in there who can talk sense. And he's trying to, you know, resist the provocation. And the whole idea, again, I think, is and they've admitted that, is to bring pressure on Putin domestically, you know, so that he might make some sort of mistake or escalate or whatever, or maybe they still hold on to the idea that, you know, the Russians will demand regime change, but all they're going to do is demand this thing get wrapped up more quickly. And I have to say, I think I would share that frustration. I think the Russians need to get on with it now, you know, but you know, I guess they're wanting to be cautious too, but it hasn't really served them too well, I don't think, being overly cautious, you know, because they're not dealing with reasonable people in any way. And it's just like Putin never really seems to fully understand that, I don't think, you know.
Putin has, like, he can't be faulted for being, for projecting his own reasonableness onto Western leaders. I think he's outgrowing it. So we'll see. With regards to, and I don't know whether either the crisis in the Middle East or the crisis in Ukraine can last until January. I suppose it can, and maybe it will. To the extent I've been off the mark on what's on either of these events, it's just assuming that probably things are going to be resolved more quickly. I mean, honestly, 2 years ago, since I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop with Zelensky being ousted for the past 2 years. You know, I've never said, oh, it's about to happen, it's about to happen. But I have been saying it could happen at any time. Well, it hasn't happened yet, but it's certainly going to happen, and I think people are getting tired of him. Yeah, people are getting tired of him. But
who's going to do the ousting? The Ukrainians domestically, or will the Russians just have to say enough and is enough? We've got to go in there and remove this guy. I mean, it must be a temptation. It must be something that the Russian people are thinking. Why is this guy still allowed to be around? The Russians, they haven't even made an attempt to remove him. Surely they could.
Yeah, and so, so I had been expecting, say, 2 years ago, when the Ukrainian death tolls, military death tolls started to climb, that you would have military brass, if not generals, maybe at least colonels, who would be in a position to overthrow and say, look, we're not just going to throw all these people in. Now, I think what's one mechanism or one phenomenon has been that the people who are probably in the best position to implement a military coup, you know, top military brass, are probably at this point themselves so implicated in the massive mishaps, the mistakes, this whole project, that they're not really in a position to do it anymore. Because what would somebody like Zeluzhny or Sirsky, you know, these generals who have presided over it, what can they say, you know, we're losing too many troops? Well, they've been presiding over it. There might be some of that. But the external support for Zelensky is completely drying up.
Yeah.
And after January, after the new administration comes in, there may be zero support for him left.
Yeah, but one thing the Western media haven't been talking about at all is that the Ukrainians yet again attacked the Zaporizhia power plant. And it's incredible to me that there's anybody who entertains the idea that it was the Russians, to make it look like a false flag or otherwise, because the Russians control the Zaporizhia power plant, and there is zero motivation for them to attack their own a power plant which they control. So it is only the Ukrainians who are capable of it. And so here we have this great support continuing for Ukraine in the West, and certainly in the established media, etc., and the institutions and government officials and everything else. And not a single word that this guy is prepared to cause a complete nuclear disaster in Ukraine. And I mean, what does he even get out of that? I mean, I guess everybody has to just, evacuate the country. You know, but I mean, if you're the Russians and you live in the border or anywhere in the vicinity of Zaporizhia, aren't you demanding that they get rid of this guy because he's a complete loose cannon, capable of anything? I mean, he will do anything to cause destruction, to save his own skin, I guess, and to prolong the situation. So, I mean, what happens if they were successful? And why aren't the IAEA, or whatever they're called, why aren't they coming out and saying, listen, Russia control this. When we get shown around the power plant, we're being shown around by Russian nuclear physicists. They control the plant, and if there's any attack on it, it's obviously coming from the Ukrainians. And why isn't there, you know, international condemnation on this? And, you know, it really is staggering to me, you know?
So, and that's a good example how irresponsible and reckless Zelensky is, and there are so many forces out there, like the IAEA, who should be standing up and saying anything. But still, at the end of the day, the Ukrainians have... The Zelensky government has no prospect of victory. Here's another example that I'm surprised nobody's talking about. Sometime last week, there was a missile attack by Ukraine on a market in Donetsk. And it targeted and caused massive... What I guess it targeted a supermarket or department store that had 200 people inside. I don't know what the death total was, but you know, this is what you have to ask. It's one thing if they're going after Russian military or Donetsk People's Republic military or even government installations, but if you're attacking civilian installations, and you're saying that these are people that you want to rule over, but you're willing to just incinerate them?
Yeah.
Doesn't that kind of validate the whole idea that that the people of these areas want to be part of Russia and don't want to be part of Ukraine? Because of course, they were bombarded by Ukraine. Between Donetsk and Lugansk, they lost 14,000 people in the 8 years prior to the Russian invasion.
Yeah, and our media doesn't acknowledge that, of course. I mean, that's just considered to be a conspiracy theory, but basically, in fact, you know, they just turn things in their head, because I saw, I think it was the Times over here, who are one of the worst. They were talking about how people in Kursk had welcomed the Ukrainians as liberators. You know, but those people in the Donetsk region, they were just, you know, as miserable as can be with the Russians coming in there, you know, so they just twist everything. But it's always been the Ukrainian playbook to try and attack civilians so it'll bring pressure and hopefully bring some cracks in Putin's power there, you know?
Yep.
And it does work to an extent,
I mean, there are people who are angry, and you'd have to admit, you'd have to think, if you were living in Russia, you'd have to say, ultimately, he's the commander in chief. And the longer this war goes on, the more of these types of events you can have. And I just think he might have been, who am I? But it seems to me he might have been better off. People are always going to escalate anyway. He might have been better, a year ago, getting rid of Zelensky and cut the head off that snake, you know?
Yeah, and that's very, very true. With Putin, one thing I think is clear is that he is a very cautious person. And if he's going to make a mistake, his mistakes are going to be on the side of being too cautious rather than too reckless. You know, we're talking about Zelensky, and Zelensky just couldn't be more reckless. He's willing to have nuclear power meltdowns and nuclear plant meltdowns, all sorts of things. He's willing to risk anything. And Putin's been extraordinarily cautious. And you can certainly make the case he's been too cautious. Of course, a lot of observers and critics had their way, maybe he would have been too reckless. And, you know, there are people in history who have been too reckless. He still seems like that he's going to prevail in this. But, of course, the longer it goes on, the bigger the window of opportunity for something really, really bad to have happen.
Well, that's the thing. So what happens, for example, if they had been – let's say that they managed – to have a successful hit on the Zaporizhia power plant, and then what? Then everyone's saying, who allowed this to happen? Putin dilly-dallied, he's been messing around with this, going on 100 meters here, 100 meters there, this war of attrition, gradual. Meanwhile, this Zelensky guy is allowed to, you know, perpetrate increasingly crazy, acts. And it's resulted in the Zaporizhia power plant. And now, then what? Well, then you know, Ukraine's uninhabitable, and parts of Russia will be affected too, and probably Poland. And who knows? You know. So, I think he's going to come under increasing pressure to get rid of this guy. You know.
Well, we'll see. Now, in January, hopefully, there's going to be there will be a new administration. Whether it's Trump or Harris, or at this point, everything. So,
but Trump is so unpredictable. You know, it's just like, I mean, Putin even said that. He said he'd rather have Biden again because Trump's so unpredictable. You know, Trump can have a certain view now on what he's going to do, and then as soon as he gets in, who's he going to staff his back room with again? Who knows? And same thing happens again. You know, and the next thing is strong rhetoric against Putin. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Putin thinks is going to change so much, and that, if Trump comes in, because, you know, someone has a word with Trump, and Trump's a different guy.
Well, exactly. So who knows what's going to happen with Trump, and what has been going on with Trump over the past several months has just been, everything's been bad. Everything's been bad. And there is Miriam Adelson, the Israeli wife with a very thick accent, of the Israeli widow of Sheldon Adelson. She's given, or at least pledged, $100 million for Trump. And she gave this speech at some sort of Jewish meeting. And if you haven't seen it, like, to hear her with her thick Israeli accent talking about Trump, the promises he made and the promises he kept. He made a promise, kept a promise. And it's so disgusting. And Trump is going on all this pro-Israel stuff. And he's coming under a lot of fire from at least elements of his own base. And he's also very, very unhappy these past few weeks. He's lost so much ground. And
yeah,
3 weeks ago, you looked at these battleground states, and not only were all of the states that are thought of as battleground states, not only were they all, was he ahead reasonably comfortable in all of them, but he was also ahead in Virginia, which is considered a pretty safe Democrat state, and he was pulling neck and neck in a couple of other states.
And what's happened? What's caused this problem for him?
Well, I mean, that was when, like, Biden was at his weakest, and Biden was under all this pressure. And now you've got Camilla and, or what's her name? Chlamydia, Kamala. And yeah. her selling point is that she's not Joe Biden. She hasn't given any press conferences. She hasn't given any
interviews.
No interviews. She's just been able, she's done a few scripted speeches. But the thing is, it's not just her. It's like Trump's kind of falling apart. He's not talking about clamping down on immigration. He's talking about giving green cards to foreign students. Any student, you know, it's really easy to get students, right? He's talking like that. He's being super pro-Israel, which, when you get down to it, that's not going to win him anybody.
It's not America first, is it?
Yeah, and he's fallen behind in all the Rust Belt states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and Arizona. He's behind so right now the electoral map is where he had a commanding lead three weeks ago. It's completely disappeared. It's completely
The final insult, you get defeated by Kamala Harris. And on that sobering note, Patrick, I think we're out of time. But thank you very much for joining me. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And I will be back again next Sunday here live on Republic Broadcasting Network on the Last Man Standing Show. Until then, take care and love you.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.